DW Spotlight on Europe.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Spotlight on Europe, the show that brings you highlights of European issues. My name is Wanjiku Mwaura from our studios in Bonn, Germany. On today's lineup, Donald Trump's new man in Brussels gives us his take on transatlantic ties.
I love Europe and I love Europeans. I like the people, I like the lifestyle. So I'm a huge fan. And frankly, I think the president is a huge fan as well, based on the conversations I've had with him. What he's not a huge fan of is trade deficits.
We also hear how EU companies plan to sidestep US sanctions on Iran, and Poland's Heat of the Year movie upsets the Catholic Church. Well, we'll come back to that and lots more, so stay tuned and enjoy. The investigative group Bellingcat claims to have identified one of the men suspected of poisoning a former Russian spy and his daughter in the UK. The group says he's a colonel with a Russian military agency, the GRU. Helen Sini now brings us the details and this roundup of European news.
British prosecutors have charged two Russian men with attempted murder in the Novichok poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter back in March. The two men recently appeared on Russian TV and denied the accusations, claiming they'd visited the UK as tourists. Now, Bellingcat, an online investigative team, says they've identified one of the men as a highly decorated colonel with Russian military intelligence. The group claims the man was given Russia's highest medal by a presidential decree back in 2014. The officer is believed to have served in Chechnya several times. The Kremlin has rejected charges it was involved in the Skripal poisoning. French President Emmanuel Macron has criticised the isolationist policies of the US and called for continued multilateralism. Macron was speaking at the UN General Assembly on Tuesday and warned that nationalism always leads to defeat. He stressed the need for dialogue with Iran, saying the Iran nuclear accord had helped curb Tehran's nuclear program. And Macron touched on climate change, launching a veiled attack on Washington's decision last year to withdraw from the Paris Climate Pact. A member of the Russian protest group Pussy Riot has been released from a German hospital after recovering from a suspected poisoning. Activist Pyotr Verziov says he's convinced he was targeted by Russia's secret service. Verziov fell ill in Moscow 2 weeks ago and was admitted to a local clinic before being flown to Germany for urgent treatment. He was suffering from symptoms including disorientation and loss of vision. German doctors found no traces of poison in his body, but said the absorption of a toxin was the most plausible explanation for his condition. A top EU court has ruled that members of the European Parliament should not be forced to disclose their expenses. The claim was brought before the European General Court back in 2015 by an association of journalists from all EU member states. The group had demanded complete transparency into how EU parliamentarians and their assistants spend their allowances. Prior to this week's ruling, the European Parliament had refused freedom of information requests related to expenses paid out to its 751 MEPs, citing data protection rules and excessive workloads. The judges on the General Court agreed and also said disclosing expenses could reveal personal information and thereby contravene EU privacy law. According to the Parliament's website, allowances currently amount to a monthly sum of nearly €4,500 per lawmaker. Sweden's Prime Minister has been voted out by Parliament 2 weeks after the country's general election. Stefan Löfven's departure was expected after the tight vote resulted in a deadlock. The centre-right opposition and the far-right ousted him in a no-confidence vote on Tuesday. But neither bloc is able to build a majority to form a new government. The far-right Sweden Democrats, who won almost 18% of votes, want more influence in return for their support in Parliament, but neither the left nor the right is willing to negotiate with them. And finally, Venice is getting tougher on tourists. City authorities are due to pass a new measure in October, which would see people fined for carrying alcohol after 7 p.m. It's aimed at cracking down on drunk revelers rather than locals leaving supermarkets with alcoholic beverages. The city may also go ahead with plans to ban sitting or lying on the ground. There's already such a ban in crowded tourist areas like St. Mark's Square. And if you're planning to visit Venice, you should also keep in mind that you're not allowed to swim in the canals, wear swimwear, or feed the birds.
Helen Sini with that news roundup. We continue today's show with news of one of the newest US ambassadors in town. Well, not here in Bonn, but in the European Union's capital, Brussels. It took 18 months for US President Donald Trump to appoint an envoy to the EU. But Gordon Sondland, who was confirmed for work almost 2 months ago, has arrived, and DW's Terry Schultz is the first journalist to interview him about the future of the EU's relationship with President Donald Trump, who we learn is actually a huge fan of Europe.
Gordon Sondland was born and raised in Seattle, Washington. He's an investor in hotels and a philanthropist, an art lover, and a major donor to the Republican Party. But Sondland's European heritage is particularly interesting in this appointment under this administration. He's the son of refugees, Germans who fled the Nazis. His father even had to be smuggled out of Germany to eventually end up in the U.S. Sondland says he has very fond feelings for Europe and that he specifically wanted to be the envoy to the EU, not to a national government. He's granted DW his first interview since starting in Brussels, and I wanted to know how Sondland squares his background with a president who's highly critical of both Europe and immigrants.
I don't share the notion that this administration rejects Europe in any way. I think this administration bifurcates our shared values and the importance of the transatlantic relationship, which encompasses many things beyond just trade, and trade as a separate issue. This administration has to have some uncomfortable conversations with close friends and allies in order to right the ship. And I don't think that in any way is a destructive perspective to take.
The ambassador says Europe should not take this personally, that in fact, President Trump does not think as poorly of the EU as some of his remarks indicate.
I love Europe and I love Europeans. When I look at my own personal travel for most of my life, 80% of it has been to European countries. And that was long before I ever considered becoming an ambassador or was offered the opportunity, because I love everything about Europe. I like the culture, I like the food, I like the charm, I like the people, I like the lifestyle. So I'm a huge fan. And frankly, I think the president is a huge fan as well, based on the conversations I've had with him. What he's not a huge fan of is trade deficits.
So it comes down to that.
I think it does.
The ambassador has met all the top EU officials and says he's received a very warm welcome. He's just visited Germany, the homeland of his parents and frequent target of his boss. But Sondland says, interestingly, the angst Europeans express about the administration publicly doesn't get repeated face to face.
I hear and see these things in the media, and then I have closed-door meetings with ministers, with senior members of the business community, and that never comes up. They're very substance focused. Let's talk about this policy. Let's talk about that policy. How do we get through this issue? How do we get through that issue? I had a conversation, for example, with a trade association and with a senior minister about medical devices. I never heard a word about, do you really hate us? Does the president dislike Germany? Do we need to get started and get ready for a trade war? I don't hear these sort of general whining things, except in the media. It is the same people who I'm talking to that then turn around and get in front of the camera and make these pronouncements, but I don't hear those behind closed doors.
Speaking of behind closed doors, U.S. and EU officials tell different stories about what happened in the recent White House meeting between President Trump and European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, where the two managed a sort of détente in what was looking very much like a transatlantic trade war. They announced new initiatives that could lead eventually to a wide-ranging trade agreement, something that would fill at least some of the gaps left by the demise of the long-negotiated Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP. The U.S. says those negotiations will include agriculture. The EU side says they won't. Sondland was present at the talks and explains the U.S. perspective.
We made it very clear to the Europeans, the president did, and the senior trade officials made it clear that everything was on the table. And in fact, everything was on the table on a bilateral basis. In other words, we invited the Europeans to put on the table any of their concerns about the way we treat their exporters. So we wanted to have a no-holds-barred, free-flowing conversation. I can tell you that if the Europeans were willing to do a deal that involved no tariffs, no barriers, no subsidies, all together as one package, I think the president would agree to that deal tomorrow.
And this threat of car tariffs would be off the table and the steel tariffs would be wiped away?
I believe if everything were wide open, then obviously all past issues would have to be resolved as part of that, yes.
And did the Europeans seem amenable to that idea?
Not today.
Sondland says the Trump administration was initially nice in its attempts to resolve trade disputes with Europe, but that the EU side did not respond. So the approach now is frank and pragmatic. But he emphasizes the U.S.-EU relationship is deep and multifaceted and measured by far more than money. He says the White House is preparing some non-trade-related initiatives he expects will be welcomed by Brussels as what he calls olive branches. So stay tuned. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
Now, still in Brussels, the European Union and Iran have now agreed to create a special vehicle to facilitate trade and financial transactions between them, sidestepping U.S. sanctions against Iran. Now, my colleague Keith Walker spoke with correspondent Georg Mattes from DW's Brussels Bureau and started by asking him to explain the background to the U.S. sanctions on Iran.
Well, first of all, we have the situation that the United States unilaterally pulled out from the Iran nuclear deal. And we have the situation that the other signatories to that deal, Russia, China, and the European Union, would like to keep the deal alive. And now they're faced with the U.S. placing sanctions on Iran, economic, trade, signs, military sanctions, you name it, they're put slapped onto Iran. But most crucially, there are secondary sanctions from the U.S. And that means these measures target foreign banks and other foreign companies that engage in certain activities involving Iran.
Okay, and how do those sanctions affect the European Union?
Well, it's particularly those secondary sanctions that are a major concern because obviously there's huge trade deals, economic ties with Iran to the European Union. And these are all now endangered by those secondary sanctions. So if a European company continues to trade with Iran, it could face sanctions from the U.S., and that's a major concern. The European Union, in the meantime, has instated a so-called blocking statute. So it has called on European businesses not to follow those U.S. sanctions and to keep trading with Iran.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And why does the EU want to dodge those sanctions? What's the ultimate goal here?
Well, put in a nutshell, the EU hopes to preserve the commercial benefits that persuaded Iran in the first place to sign this deal. And what they got in return is that Iran curbs its atomic energy program. And from the perspective of the EU, from the perspective of all signatories apart from the US, Iran has followed that deal. They have fulfilled their part. And that is why the EU says we would like to keep our part in place as well, so this deal can stay alive despite the fact that the US walked off.
Okay, how important is the Iranian market for EU companies?
Well, we can look at some numbers, and you have the overall value of EU trade with Iran, which in 2017 was about $23 billion.
Ooh, okay.
And then you have German companies alone that traded goods worth 3 billion euros. But, you know, the point here is they trade with the U.S. 35 times as much. And there's no doubt that for German companies, for European companies, they rather pull their investment from Iran than risk a much bigger investment they have with business going to the U.S.
OK, that makes sense. Now, the new vehicle that they are talking about, how will that system work?
It's an interesting system, and we're not fully clear yet how we haven't given the details yet. But there's, for example, so Iran could ship crude oil to a French firm, accumulating credit that could then be used to pay an Italian manufacturer for goods shipped the other way. And that would mean there's no funds, no money changing hands. And in that way, the U.S. could not monitor those transactions.
Okay.
And you could sort of conceal that business from U.S. eyes.
Okay, so it's like a bartering system.
Exactly. It's that, and also there's the aspect of an accounting firm, so a state-backed financial intermediary that could help making transactions. And, you know, looking at it, we have a bizarre situation. The key ally of Europe, the United States, is treated in a way like acting like criminals. They try to hide transactions working together with Russia and China in order to conceal business from one of their key allies, which is the U.S.
Okay, will big multinationals such as Siemens and Total, will they use this new vehicle, this new system?
Well, the vast majority of European firms have already pulled out. You have car makers Daimler, German Rail, German Telecom, chemical giant BASF, who've all said, look, we have to finish business as here. And you've heard from Siemens, for instance, that they're scaling back as well. Put in a nutshell, they all rather pull their investment from Iran, which is small or peanuts compared
sure.
to the business they have with the United
with
States.
With the US. Okay, that makes sense. Georg Mattis from DW's Brussels Bureau.
Are still listening to Spotlight on Europe. If you're just joining us, welcome. This is the show bringing you highlights of European issues. Human rights groups have accused Italy of reaching a new low when it comes to its approach to refugees and migrants. Italy is allegedly putting pressure on Panama to revoke the flag it granted the Aquarius, a migrant rescue ship, to operate in the Mediterranean Sea. The condemnation of Italy comes as its new populist government passed a controversial anti-migrant decree aimed at immigrants in Italy, and as the Aquarius migrant rescue ship once again struggles to find a safe port for the people it rescues. Megan Williams has the latest from Rome.
Circumstances exceptional, measure exceptional. Qu'elles autorisent de manière humanitaire.
The latest plea for the beleaguered Aquarius migrant rescue ship came from the head of Médecins Sans Frontières, Frédéric Pénard. He issued a desperate request for France to take in the 58 people plucked from the sea north of Libya that nobody wants. Since this summer, Italy has refused to welcome rescued migrants in its ports. Its new populist far-right government says the country has already taken in its share, and it's now up to other EU countries to welcome the desperate people. This latest European standoff over migrants was resolved a few days later when Malta agreed to transfer the 58 children, women and men onto another ship in international waters, to then be distributed among France, Spain, Portugal and Germany. It's a short-term solution to the latest rescue of migrants escaping conflict and extreme poverty, a wave of desperate people that shows no sign of ending. And it's the latest incident in what head of rescue aboard the Aquarius, Nick Romaniak, says is a shameful European-wide attack on humanitarian rescuers.
We are being completely blindsided. There's no information coming to the Aquarius. We're being boycotted by merchant vessels in the area. There is no information being sent to us by the Libyan authorities or the Italian authorities. And the information is about boats in distress. It's about people in danger who need to be saved immediately.
Romaniak with SOS Mediterranee is on board the Aquarius with the rescued people. He says the rescue ship, the only one now in the Mediterranean south of Italy, is being purposefully isolated. He says up until several months ago, the rescue headquarters in Italy would share information with boats in distress with the Aquarius. Now, Italy no longer tells them about boats in distress or gives them the go-ahead to rescue migrant boats in trouble. Instead, it tells the Aquarius to get in touch with the Libyan Coast Guard. But the Libyan Coast Guard, says Romaniak, refuses to respond to their calls and has even threatened the Aquarius when it's moved to rescue people.
It's no longer just the wind and the waves and technical problems. These are the traditional things that cause people to die at sea. It's now politicians and their policies that are causing people to die in the Central Mediterranean. And no one cares about this. No one's worried about it. They said, we will stop people arriving in Europe, stop people arriving at all costs. If they have to die, well, it looks like European politicians and certain people in the public are quite happy to let this happen.
The official death rate in the Mediterranean is now the highest it's been in years, about one for every 17 migrants who risk the journey in flimsy rubber boats. As the Aquarius copes with hostility at sea, the vessel is facing another obstacle. Panama revoked their flag to operate in the Mediterranean, a move that human rights groups say came under fierce economic and political pressure on Panama by the Italian government. As the Aquarius looks for a new flag to fly under, Italy's new populist far-right government passed a security decree, making it easier to expel migrants in Italy and strip refugees of their status. Far-right leader and Vice Premier Matteo Salvini insists the controversial bill will make Italy stronger to fight smugglers and expel what he calls fake refugees. Human rights advocates oppose the bill, including a controversial measure that will strip immigrants of their Italian nationality if they're convicted of terrorism. Megan Williams, DW Radio, Rome.
Now, we all know the power of film. We all know there's almost nothing more powerful than to see people on film that look and talk like you, like we do. That is a quote by Meera Nair, an Indian-American filmmaker living in New York. Now, films and movies across the world have created many reactions. For example, in Kenya, the film Rafiki, meaning friend, was banned by the country's Film Commission Board for portraying a love story between two women. But Kenya is not the only one to react this way to a work of art. In Poland, a movie which promised to be the country's biggest hit has incurred the wrath of the country's powerful Roman Catholic Church for its frank portrayal of how many of its priests defy its teachings in their private lives. A crusade against the movie, which is called The Clergy, has been launched by state-controlled media and conservative intellectuals. But commentators point out that it perfectly captures the way a large proportion of Polish society feels about the church's meddling in politics and ordinary people's lives. From Warsaw, Julian Berna files this report.
Emotions ran high at this year's National Film Festival in the Baltic Pole city of Gdynia as the prize of the audience was announced. It went to The Clergy, perhaps the most keenly expected movie of the past two decades. No stranger to controversy, director Wojciech Smarzowski loves breaking taboos. He has previously exposed such social ills as the acceptance of drunkenness in Polish society, police brutality, corruption, and the mindless existence of the new middle class. This time he has zoomed in on what many in Poland call a state within the state, the secret of Roman Catholic clergy. The vices of the central characters, both parish priests and bishops, such as greed, immorality, and acceptance of paedophilia, make them look truly revolting. In this scene, a notorious paedophile priest, whose dirty secret has long been known to the whole parish, but who is protected by the church hierarchy, is chased by his parishioners who've just had enough. Other priests shown in the movie are seen extorting money from parishioners for weddings and funerals. There's a bishop notorious for his double standards. There are drinking bouts with foul language. And there's a young priest caught between his love for a woman and the rigid rules of celibacy. The message is clear. Too many Catholic priests in Poland are out of control and the church does little to stop the rot. At a news conference at the Gdynia Film Festival, director Wojciech Smarzowski explained he was compelled to make the movie.
I shoot my films to make people think about certain issues they wouldn't normally think about. I want them to be moved. I want to tackle burning social issues. This time, it's about the church, an institution which is above the law in Poland. Church finances are not transparent, though the state subsidizes it, even out of my own taxes. If a priest is found to have molested children in his parish, and even if the case ends up in court, instead of being swept under the carpet as it used to be until recently, the priest is simply transferred to another parish. In my films, emotionally, I'm always on the side of the victim.
But in Poland's present political climate, under a conservative nationalist government allied with the church, Smarzowski's film simply isn't welcome. State-controlled television rails against it, calling it a product of a morally bankrupt intellectual elite. The chief of the national state broadcaster, Jacek Kurski, a ruling party appointee, doesn't beat about the bush as he slams the director's work and those who agree with its message.
Smarzowski has exaggerated this picture of the church. He picked some marginal problems and made it seem like all of the clergy were corrupt and immoral. The prize that the movie won at the festival is a moral aberration. It's a provocative, trashy movie. It's a disgrace that its premiere coincides with the 40th anniversary of the inauguration of the Polish Pope, John Paul II, and the centenary of Poland's rebirth as an independent state. The country would still be enslaved if it hadn't been for the heroism of the Polish Catholic Church.
Some critics, like Catholic writer and activist Barbara Stanisławczyk-Żyła, go even further. According to her, Smarzowski represents dangerous forces that are chipping away at the values Europe rests on.
We have entered a crucial stage in the current war of civilizations. We're heading for a showdown. The church finds itself under frontal attack because it's the bastion of all the values that Christian civilization represents. Without the church's consistent work, European civilization as we know it will crumble, and it's our duty to prevent this from happening.
But in spite of this chorus of disapproval, box office takings for The Clergy look very impressive indeed, far exceeding even the commercial success of recent Hollywood hits. University of Warsaw academic Professor Jacek Dobrowolski argues that it's not just because of the controversy which surrounds the film. He believes that Polish society is tired of the ambivalent relationship between the church and state, as a result of which the notion of democracy in Poland has been twisted.
I wouldn't go so far as to say that we are Iran in the middle of Europe. But on the other hand, what does it say about a democracy if a non-democratic institution has so much to say in it? Their using of the ideas of freedom, democracy, freedom of religion especially, was purely instrumental. And to introduce democracy in the way they understood democracy. That this democracy is anti-communism. Democracy means that we will be free to be Catholic.
Worryingly to many, in spite of the movie's artistic merit and powerful message, the jury of the Gdynia Film Festival awarded the top prize to another production. In a comical twist, the organizers even made a mess of explaining why a piece of equipment that measures the length and volume of the applause, which is normally announced for the longest and loudest standing ovation, supposedly broke down just before the applause for the clergy was measured. There have also been some dark rumblings from the Culture Ministry that state funding for new movies should be awarded more carefully. This raises question marks over how much freedom of expression will be tolerated by the government in the future. Julian Berner, DW, Warsaw.
With that, we come to the end of this edition of Spotlight on Europe. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Did you know you can actually connect with us? Yes, we would love to engage with you on our Facebook page, DW Africa, or you can also write to us an email via feedback.africa@dw.com. Thanks to my producer, Helen Sini, and our technician, Gerd Gyorgi. And thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next week with another edition of Spotlight on Europe. I'm Wanjiko Mwaura. From all of us here at DW, we wish you a wonderful time. Alles, was du so erzählst, hört sich um.